Starry, starry night. Flaming flowers that brightly blaze. Swirling clouds in violet haze. Reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue. Colors change.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. As the sun goes down and day fades to night, we call it dark. It's what we've been taught, it's what we know. To a brilliant night sky filled with infinite stars, most of us have to travel to far rural parts, away from cities and towns where artificial light from developed areas create a glow, making our darkness a little brighter. Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, joins us to talk about real organic darkness. Welcome to the show, Paul.
It's great to be here.
Great, great. You know, most of us think when it's nighttime, it's dark. Dark is dark. But that's not necessarily true. There are different degrees of darkness. I had no idea. And there's actually a scale that measures darkness. Can you talk about when and why there became a need to quantify darkness?
Absolutely. So the scale that you're talking about is called the Bortle scale, and it comes from an amateur astronomer in upstate New York who about 12 or 15 years ago was getting tired of having younger amateur astronomers invite him out to places saying, "You have to come out here, it's so dark." And he would get out there, and he realized that it really wasn't so dark. And in fact, that these younger folks really had not experienced what true darkness was. So he came up with this 9-point scale that starts at 9 with our brightest places and works its way down to 1, which would be primordial darkness, kind of darkness with no evidence of artificial light. And some of the things that stand out to me about this scale is that contrary to what we all probably think of, and you alluded to this in your introduction, most of us really don't experience real darkness anymore. In fact, most of us on the scale live most of our lives in levels of darkness that would equate to about 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And not very many of us get to experience that those dark levels of darkness down below the level 5.
You know, apparently our night skies have been becoming more unnatural, if you will, for some 50 years or more. We're losing natural darkness every day to what you call artificial light pollution, which was a new term for me. But, you know, I really hadn't given any thought to different depths of darkness until I started researching this topic, you know, much less this artificial light pollution. But that's a term that you, you know, that you'd like to see more people know about, artificial light pollution.
Yeah, I think so. And you make a good point. You know, the folks that I talked to for the book, the activists and who've been working on this issue for a while, make the point that about even 20 years ago when they would talk to folks, most people had never heard the word light and pollution together. And now that's beginning to change. I think more and more people are beginning to understand that we're using just way more light than we need to use, and we're using it in ways that have some real costs to us. And I guess I would just make the point right off the bat that you know, none of the people that I talked to for the book were talking about having no lights. I mean, I think everybody recognizes that the miracle of light at night brings so many benefits to us, and so we're not talking about doing away with light. It's just that we're using, as I said, way more than we need to use, and we're using it in ways that really are costly and irresponsible to.
How close are we to, I guess, the truly dark sky becoming extinct, so to speak?
Well, it's a great question, and if we use the Bortle scale that we were talking about a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. Most people would say that there really are no level 1 areas left in the lower 48, so that real sort of primitive darkness that would have covered the whole continent before the advent of electric light. There's certainly around the world are levels of this primitive darkness, level 1, you know, out in the middle of the ocean and more remote areas. But what I was really interested in for the book especially, was to think about the levels of darkness that most of us experience most of the time, and encourage us to think about how valuable darkness is to us where we live, and then to also maybe talk about, as I got toward the end of the book, some of these areas like, say, the national parks out west, for example, that still have really quite beautiful dark skies, even if they aren't at this, you know, really strict level one that Bortle talks about.
Right, right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we're discussing the effects artificial light has on natural darkness with Paul Bogard. He's the author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. And if you have a story about the darkest, starriest sky that you've ever seen and you want to share it, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said a moment ago, Paul, that, you know, kind of getting back to that darkness scale, that most of us live somewhere kind of in the middle. Could you describe what that is like, what, you know, these middle numbers are like?
Sure, absolutely. So the middle numbers kind of correspond actually to kind of the suburbs, I would say, or maybe starting to get out into the rural areas. And so above that would be living in the city. And a good gauge of what we've lost is the night sky. And so, for example, I was living in Winston-Salem, North Carolina for a couple of years, and I remember walking home one night in the fall, and I saw the constellation Orion, which is a beautiful constellation that many of us would recognize. It's in his belt. And I saw those main stars, and I thought, well, that's pretty good. I'm living in a city of 200,000 people, and I can still see Orion. But then I realized that those stars that I'm seeing are brighter than about 98 or 99% of the stars that we ought to be able to see in the sky. Mm-hmm. So essentially over any city of any size in the U.S. or around the world, frankly, we've lost now 98% of the stars. And instead of seeing, for example, the 2,000 stars that the human eye could see on a clear, dark night, most of us are seeing a couple dozen stars, maybe 50 stars at the most. So we've really lost that, what was for ages the most common human experience of walking out and seeing this truly starry night. That's now one of the most rare common experiences.
Absolutely. Now, probably going to reveal something about myself. I'm not sure what that would be, but as I do with many books, I flip to the last chapter of yours first, and it's titled The Darkest Places, and you described Death Valley National Park at night, and it's considered one of the darkest places in the lower 48, and your description of this, I have to say, kind of gave me chills, left me eager to schedule a trek out west. Mm-hmm. Would you describe for our listeners what you saw there, what that dark sky experience was like?
Sure, and thanks for your kind words about the book. It was one of those magic experiences. I was lucky enough to go out with a guy named Dan Dorisco, who's part of the National Park Service's night sky team. And so he took me to a couple places in Death Valley National Park that are some of the darkest places he's ever been. And he's been all over the Park Service. What we saw that night, what I experienced that night, was something that most Americans never get to experience, which is a night sky that where the stars are coming all the way down to the horizon, for example. I had that experience of it seemed like the stars were falling off the edge of the earth kind of thing, and just no artificial lights in any direction. And maybe one of the most amazing experiences, part of this experience, was that I think we forget that our eyes are truly remarkable organs and that they can see fairly well in the dark. If you stay out for 10 minutes, you'll see better. If you stay out for 45 minutes, you'll see even better. But let me tell you, when you are out there in a place like Death Valley for 2 or 3 hours, something amazing happens where all of a sudden you begin to see like you've never seen before. And it's the sense of seeing the stars in three dimensions that most of us just never have the chance to experience anymore.
Absolutely. Paul, we're going to go to a caller really quick. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Go ahead with your story.
Yes. 30 years ago, I was camping in Wayne National Forest down in Hocking Hills, and I was able to go into a very dark area and look up into the sky and see the Milky Way to where it just painted across the sky. And it was, I haven't been able to see it. I mean, there's so much artificial light. There's so much artificial noise constantly around. And it was just a real treat. It's just something that I remember from many years ago. And it was visible, and I remember it, but it's a shame it's gone.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your story, David. Paul, for your geography, Hocking Hills is kind of rural southern Ohio, and I hope I'm getting that right as an Alabama native. But, you know, it's kind of telling that even in some of the most rural parts of Ohio, you're still not able these days to see the Milky Way. I don't recall ever seeing the Milky Way in my lifetime.
Well, yeah, and I'm struck by your caller's remarks. I hear this often from people who say, you know, 30 years ago I saw X, Y, and Z. And when I give talks about this subject, it is almost always the folks who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, or older who come up afterwards or who raise their hand and say, I had this experience. And it's almost never folks who are younger than that, because most of us who are younger than, say, 50 have grown up just swamped in light. We don't know any different. We've never had this firsthand experience. And I think that one of the most troubling things for me with this issue is the way that our children are growing up now without having a firsthand experience of seeing the Milky Way, of being awed, being inspired by this amazing, breathtaking sight, you know, and there's just a lot of different costs to that.
Absolutely. Well, before we take a quick break, I want to go to another caller here. Matt from New Albany, you're on the air. Tell us your story.
Well, first of all, I'm going to go ahead and contradict what he just said. I'm 34, and growing up just south of Columbus in the country, I do remember the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of those things that I didn't remember it until I came back out into the country, having lived in Columbus for a while and just kind of being depressed at the overall. Well, going back out and seeing the lights and then, you know, thinking, you know, for the past 15 years, I haven't been able to see this. And like you say, it is depressing kind of thinking that my children won't be able to see that unless they travel far.
All right. Thanks for the call, Matt.
Thanks.
Yeah, it is sad to think that it one day we may have to travel outside of the U.S. if we're going to actually get to see some really, cosmic magic happen, other than traveling out west. Let's take a quick break. Paul Bogard, author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, will be back when we come back from the break. He's going to keep talking about how to preserve natural darkness. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Continue in just a moment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. This hour, we're talking about how artificial light is snuffing out our natural darkness. Paul Bogard, who is the author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, is on a mission to reverse this trend. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Good to be here.
And we want to throw this out to our listeners. If you have a story, about the darkest sky you've seen, give us a call at 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's that, I want to go back to this Death Valley National Park. It's that kind of darkness that you and others are trying to preserve. And, you know, I get the feeling that you see artificial light pollution as real pollution. Like, you want it to be treated as a kind of pollution. You know, I think a lot of people maybe haven't thought about artificial lights that way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things that I like about this issue is that it's something that we can so readily address. And so compared to some of the other kinds of pollution that we have to deal with in this world, light pollution is one that is fairly simple to solve. One of the things that we can first, I guess, recognize that the vital importance of darkness for our human health, for ecological health, and for some of the reasons we've already talked about. But then also to think about how just by shielding our lights, that is, just to ensure that our light isn't spraying all over the place, we could go far in controlling it. And I think in terms of the term light pollution, I think it's just a way to get people's attention to the fact that we're using way more light than we need. We're wasting a lot of light, and it's costing us in so many ways, including the pocketbook. We're wasting somewhere close to $2 billion a year simply in light that's sent up into the sky. It's not doing anyone any good.
Absolutely. You know, once, you know, you kind of have people at least intrigued, and once you convince them that this is a problem, where do you find the balance between preservation and modern society? You kind of hit on this earlier, touched on it briefly about we have to have light. But where's the balance, and what is the benefit of maybe going a little bit darker?
Sure. Well, you know, the safety and security issue is one that comes up immediately, and it's something that I talk about fairly soon in the book, just because I know that. And light is good. Light is something that we want to have. It does help us be a little safer and more secure at night. But I think the mistake that we make is thinking that because light can help us be safe and more secure, that automatically more light will make us be more safe and secure. And that's where the equation falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that I talk to who are, you know, deeply into working on this issue, lighting designers, electricians, that kind of thing, told me that, you know, bright light is actually can make us less safe and secure at night by blinding us, by casting shadows, by creating the illusion of safety. And so what we're trying to do with this issue is to help people understand that light at night is good, it's a miracle, it's amazing, but we're just using way more of it than we need, and it's costing us in all these different ways.
How does somebody, you know, on a small scale, and then maybe it grows and grows and grows, but, you know, what are some suggestions that you have for people that kind of want to get on this, I guess, trend, if not trend, but I can't find the word that I'm looking for, but,
sure.
You know, somebody that wants to start helping with this issue?
Sure. And, you know, my goal with the book was to raise awareness of the issue. So I think that's the first thing I would encourage people to do is just to start to see the light, as it were. You know,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes apologize to people when I give talks because I say, you know, I'm going to point out light pollution to you and then you're going to see it everywhere you go. One good place to get a lot of information about the subject is the International Dark Sky Association. That's darksky.org. On the web, they have a real treasure trove of information about the issue. And in terms of what we can do about it, you can, even the lights on your house, you can do things like buying fixtures that direct the light downward rather than out into our eyes, for example. It's funny, when most folks, we love the way lights look during the day, and most of us choose our lights for our houses based on how they look during the day. They look pretty, and then we forget about at night when they're blasting light all over the place. So you can choose fixtures that direct the light downward. You can become involved in your community and raise the issue of when your community is going to install new streetlights, for example. Make sure those streetlights are pointed downward, that they're not spraying light all over the place. There's all sorts of things we can do from the individual level all the way up to, say, the statewide level. the state of New Mexico, for example, has a lighting ordinance that directs that any new lights will be these shielded lights that I'm talking about. So there really are things that we can do about this issue.
You know, I think I was reading somewhere you mentioned kind of a ripple effect that, you know, perhaps it in the big cities they start getting on the bandwagon and turning down the lights. And so then in the suburbs it becomes darker, and then therefore the countryside becomes darker again.
Exactly. I mean, the situation that we have now is that we're getting ever brighter. The light in the U.S. is growing at some 6% a year is the estimate. So the effect of that is that as our cities grow brighter and brighter and brighter, that light is flooding out into the suburbs, the rural areas, even into our more wild areas. But the optimistic thing is that that can be flipped, as it were. So even though our cities are still going to have lights, we still want lights, if we on the level of lighting in our cities, it will have this opposite ripple effect where our suburbs, our rural areas, our wild areas will start to see their night skies return. We'll start to see their darkness return. And that's an exciting thing.
I want to go to a caller here who has a suggestion of something that we might be able to do to help with this light pollution. Steve in Columbus, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Why can't we have one day a year, one day every 10 years, the whole state turns out their lights, the street lights, one day every 10 years?
That would be interesting. I wonder what kind of sky that I might see near downtown Columbus, other than just a couple of stars in the sky that I generally see. Just a few stars I can count on one hand. Thanks for the call, Steve.
You know, it's an interesting idea. And in fact, there already are a couple of things going on around the world that are similar, which the first one I think of is Earth Hour, which is every March for 1 hour on a Saturday. Cities and suburbs and are encouraged to turn out their lights for an hour as a way to raise awareness about our energy use. But it really has a dramatic effect showing us on how much light we have. And then other places, say the country of Belgium, they have a nationwide day of the night. Now it's become an annual thing where they have they organize all sorts of cities and towns, organize activities for their citizens to be out at night, and they turn down the lights or they turn out the lights just to raise awareness of the value of darkness to all of us.
Let's go to another caller. I'm interested to hear her story. Megan in Columbus, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I just kind of wanted to share a really cool story. I was really fortunate in that my father took me up to Glacier National Park. I'm 20 now, but at the time I must have been in high school. And still to this day, the stars that I saw, I dragged him to the lake really late at night, and he didn't want to go. But as soon as he saw the stars, we had to run back and get my mom and my sister because the stars were absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I still to this day am surprised to hear, you know, living in Columbus, having a lot of friends on especially the East Coast and towards the east of the U.S., a lot of them have never seen the stars like I have seen them. And I think a part of that might have had to do with me living on the West Coast. It seems like there's so much more expanses of land out there that you're given more of an opportunity to see them than you are here. But unfortunately.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Megan. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You know, Paul, that's one thing that you said in your book, that the best dark places are west of the Mississippi, because, you know, clearly much of the development started on the East Coast and moved west. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that caller, I imagine, would be right.
Well, she is in general, although I would say, too, that there are a couple of real special places on the East Coast, like Acadia National Park up in Maine is really wonderful. There's a place just across the border in Quebec that's a wonderful place. And there are what we call star parties, these gatherings of amateur astronomers that get together, bring their telescopes, and show us the night sky. And generally, many of these are open to the public. And these are all over the East Coast as well. It's you know, it is still dark out there. It's not as though, you know, there is no darkness or any stars left. It's just that it's not as it used to be, and it's getting worse. And unless we become aware of the extent of light pollution and the costs that it's what it's costing us, it will just continually get worse until we truly have lost the ability to see the stars.
You've traveled all over the U.S. and Europe looking for natural darkness, and people who are doing lighting well, and you say that some cities are doing it better than others. I'm guessing Vegas is not on at the top of your list. But you talk about Paris in your book, and that city actually has a lighting designer, which blew my mind. Can you talk about what Paris is doing right and how that might, you know, kind of transfer over here in the States?
For sure. Paris is such a wonderful example. We know it. Its nickname, you know, the City of Light.
Mm-hmm.
And so people go over to Paris. One of the things they love about Paris is Paris at night. And Paris as a city has consciously created this atmosphere. And the way they've done it is to think about their lighting very carefully. And the guy you're talking about, Francois Jousse, this wonderful character who took me around and showed me all the different things they'd done over the last 30 years to essentially relight Paris. So they took it from a city that was, like so many cities were and continue to be, simply lit kind of by floodlight. We just kind of set up these really bright lights and kind of flood the sides of buildings and call it good.
Mm-hmm.
He changed that to use lighting to accentuate the beauty of the architecture and to create a nighttime atmosphere that will help draw people to Paris. And so one of the ways that this can be transferred to other communities is through the use of lighting designers and through the use of being conscious of the things we can do with light to create beauty, to enhance safety, to make our cities, and many cities and towns will spend tens of thousands of or even hundreds of thousands of dollars on their daytime appearance, and then at night they seem to just kind of forget what they look like, and they're kind of mini Vegases with light shining all over the place. We really can do a lot with our nighttime appearance to make the places that we live more habitable, more beautiful.
We've got a caller who has a question for you. I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer it, but let's get him on the air and see if you can. Jerry in Clark County, thanks for calling the show.
Hello, thanks for being on. I live in an area that had been agricultural and now it's developing in some respects, but we built a new school, and at night when they just turned the new lights on over there, it looks like we've got a new city.
Mm.
I'd like to send them a letter or something to say that we need to muffle that, but I'm not real good at my prose, so do you have some tool, a form letter or citing the benefits of cutting these lights that I could get?
Yeah, thanks for the question, and it's a really common experience for people all around the country where a new school or a hospital or some new development comes in, and all of a sudden an area that was dark is brilliant, you know, very brightly lit up. What I would encourage your caller to do and anybody listening to do is, again, go to the International Dark Sky Association website, that darksky.org, and ask them and look. I think I haven't looked specifically for this recently, but I think they may have letters like the one your caller is asking for, and if nothing else, they can help you with that kind of thing. And the you know, the objection that people are going to hear again and again is that we need all these lights for safety and security, and I think that what I'm hoping folks will continue to think about is, you know, actually, we're using way more light than we need for that, and that with a little forethought, we can actually have a new school that's intelligently and thoughtfully lit and not spraying light all over the place.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Jerry.
Thank you.
Thanks. Is there any legal recourse? I don't want to get too far ahead of myself because I know that there are some laws around the country about light pollution, but do people have any legal recourse to, you know, to, I guess, get people to turn down the lights?
Yeah, it's a good question. And unfortunately, I think the answer is difficult one. You know, we have the analogy I use in the book is that if your neighbor is having a loud party, you can call the police and the police will come over and, you know, settle the party down or break the party up, and you can have your quiet back and go to sleep. But if your neighbor is just blasting his or her lights all over the place, and so many of us live in places where we lie down in our bed at night and our neighbor's lights are shining through our bedroom windows, which is something that we call light trespass, there's really nothing we can do. I think, you know, if you called the police and said, hey, my neighbor's lights are shining through my bedroom window, they would, you know, might not care too much. And I think that's really unfortunate because it is a real nuisance. And we haven't talked too much yet about the human health effects, but when you start to think about some of the effects that artificial light at night is having on our bodies, that's increasingly being documented, it becomes less of a laughing or trivial matter and more of a serious matter where your neighbor is, it's akin, one of the researchers at Harvard said to me, it's like secondhand smoke, where when we first raised the question of secondhand smoke, people thought, oh, that's not a big deal. He says, you know, it's like secondhand light. It's like your neighbor's allowed to have bright lights, but once those start infringing on your life, then it becomes a more serious issue.
Well, and it's even, there have been studies recently that people tell you to put down the phones, turn off the TVs, and it's not because of the content, it's because of the light, and that light actually will keep you up at night and keep you from going to sleep. So there definitely seems to be real, you know, health concerns with light.
Yeah, there really are. And, you know, the research on this is new, as you might expect, because light pollution has been a relatively recent phenomenon. But what we're finding is that artificial light at night is affecting our sleep. It's confusing our body's circadian rhythms, and it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin in our bodies, which this has been linked to the growth of cancer, especially breast and prostate cancer, so much that the World Health Organization now lists working the night shift as a probable carcinogen. So we're having increasing, you know, problems with exhaustion, with sleep disorders, with obesity, diabetes. All these things are increasingly being tied by researchers to all this light that we're experiencing at night. Not only, I mean, it's one thing if you work at night and you don't have a choice, but the rest of us are reading our tablets, our computers in bed, we're watching TV, and we're sleeping with the lights on, and it's starting to seem like this is having a real effect on human health.
That's a good place to stop. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion with Paul Bogert. He's the author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, and his efforts to preserve natural darkness. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll continue in just a moment.
Up on a star makes no difference who you are, anything your heart desires.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we're discussing the effects of artificial light on natural darkness. Our guest is Paul Bogert. He's the author of the new book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Thanks for hanging in there with us, Paul.
No, it's fun to be here.
Very good. And for the listeners, if you want to call in and share a story about the darkest, starriest sky you've ever seen, call 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org and call in with questions too if you have any questions about artificial light. I wanted to get back quickly to We're talking about health effects, a little bit about artificial light. And recently I heard on the television news that they're suggesting parents even pull the night lights for children because that's having an effect on their sleep. I just wonder if it's a matter of getting this movement started, Paul, and getting people kind of educated and on board with, you know, the true effects of artificial light pollution.
Well, I really think it is. You know, people often ask me if I'm, you know, depressed about how bad it is or optimistic about what we can do. And I think that, you know, the reality of the spread of artificial light is there. I mean, it's all over the place and it's getting worse. And yet, there's real reason for optimism because I think that once people become aware of the costs of all this light and then the relative ease that is controlling this light, I think more and more people will say, you know, it's kind of crazy why we're doing it this way. It's so easy to do it more thoughtfully and responsibly. Let's do that. And I think, for example, you raised the nightlight for kids subject. And I think, first of all, what studies are telling us are that the best thing for us when it comes to sleep is to sleep in the dark. And that means dark, dark. It doesn't mean, you know, with a nightlight or anything like that. Really as dark as you can. But if you must have a nightlight, have a red bulb or a red shade because that will make the light a little less harmful to you. That light at night, and it seems like it's becoming, researchers finding that it takes less and less amount of light to have these effects on us. So even a small nightlight could be having these.
Oh, are you still there, Paul?
I am still there.
Okay, good. It sounded like we had lost you there for a second.
No.
You know, it sounds like you do say that this is an easy fix, and some people may say, okay, yeah, whatever. But there is a city in this country that does do it right, it seems like, and that would be Flagstaff, Arizona. And I've been learning a whole lot of stuff in researching this topic. It was named by the International Dark Sky Association. Who knew there was such a thing?
Mm-hmm.
But it named it its first official dark sky city. And as a result, Flagstaff actually implemented lighting codes where they're turning off parking lot lights, turning down gas stations. So this seems to be like this is actually doable.
Oh, it's absolutely doable. And Flagstaff is a wonderful example. Tucson, Arizona, a few hours south, is another good example in a much larger city where they have what we call lighting codes or lighting ordinances. And this is simply, rules in line that make sure that when new lights are put up, they're these shielded lights that I've been talking about. Both of these places took on these codes, these guidelines, because of the local astronomy observatories there. They had astronomers looking at the stars. But this is really something that could benefit any city. And I think that, you know, I don't want to make it seem like I think this is an easy fix, you know, that it's going to be simple. But again, compared to some of the other issues that we're dealing with, it is relatively easy. And I'm not saying, you know, let's not worry about those other things. Let's just focus on light pollution. But I am saying, you know, this is kind of low-hanging fruit. This is a problem that we can so readily grasp, that we can so readily do something about. I think that by doing that, it could really help folks become aware of the way that we're using resources in the country and that we can do something about these many issues rather than think, oh, there's, you know, nothing we can do.
Because it wouldn't just benefit our eyes or benefit our views of the sky. It would, like you pointed to a lot earlier, it would benefit the pocketbooks of companies and municipalities, even our own savings on energy bills.
Yeah, exactly. As I was talking to an Italian astronomer, and he said, it's all wins. You know, he just win, 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 win. There's almost no one benefits from the way that we're using light now, which is irresponsibly, wastefully, And I think that we all will benefit from using light much more thoughtfully and responsibly.
Let's take a quick call from Helen in Columbus. She's been waiting on patiently on the line for a while to make her recommendation of a dark sky, at least nearby for some of us here in the Midwest. Helen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, we are planning a trip to northern Michigan and going to Emmett County at Dark Sky Park. I don't know if you've been there or heard of it. When you mentioned the red nightlight, they do recommend that if you bring a flashlight, that it's a red light to minimize, you know, brightness.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard of Emmett County Dark Sky Park?
Yeah, absolutely. I have yet to be there, but I've talked with Mary Adams, who's the organizer up there, and has done so much good work on behalf of Dark Skies there.
They have a website and a really great video of the starry skies, and I believe it's in different seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Helen. You know, I went to Michigan myself earlier this summer, and that probably is the starriest sky I've seen in a while. I was on the western side of Michigan, and it's the darkest place I've been in a very, very long time. You know, I want to read this really quickly from a Facebook message from Ellen. She says, I agree with all that is being said about light pollution. However, I don't think you have to go out west to see the Milky Way. She says, we have a vacation house in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, where it is so dark at night, you can't see your hand in front of your face. The stars the star shows at night are spectacular. Have you been to West Virginia, Paul?
I haven't, but I'm planning actually to go in September, so that sounds pretty great. And I have a similar place. You know, the special place in my life is in northern Minnesota, where I grew up, you know, standing at the end of the dock looking out over a lake, seeing the Milky Way mirrored in the water there. And I guess I would just say that it is still dark there, and there still are dark places all over the country, yet they're just not as dark as they used to be. And maybe the bigger point is that almost everywhere is getting brighter, and almost nowhere is getting darker.
You know, I think some of the darkest places are probably our national parks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you mentioned Acadia. We've talked about Death Valley. What are you or others doing to work with parks to help reduce artificial light pollution? Is this something that they're addressing already, or...?
They are. Just within the last 10 years or so, they've created what they're calling the Night Sky Team. That is a small group of Park Service employees going around and measuring the levels of darkness in each park area as a way of quantifying what we have right now so that we can preserve it, so that we can make it better. The thing about darkness is that it is disappearing rapidly, in the sense of, you know, if you went back 20 or 50 or certainly 100 years ago, you would be shocked by how much light there is now in the sky. But it's happening. We're losing it just slowly enough that it's really hard to perceive. One good example I often give is that on average now our gas stations and parking lots are lit 10 times as brightly as they were just 20 years ago. And for most of us, you know, 20 years ago is not that far in the past, and yet this is so much brighter, and we're just not aware of it. So this Night Sky Team from the Park Service is doing everything they can to raise the awareness within the parks, with the rangers, with the superintendents, about this issue, and to create activities for visitors to the parks. And
mm-hmm.
I think the reason why what's happening in the national parks is so exciting is that, you know, these are oftentimes remote areas, but they're remote areas that we know and that we love and that we care about. They're not remote areas where nobody ever goes, and so we don't notice if it's getting brighter. These are places that are really special to us, and I think another reason to be optimistic about this issue is because of the work the parks are doing and raising the awareness and saying darkness is important to these parks. It's part of this experience, and we need to act now to preserve what we have.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we're discussing the effects artificial light has on natural darkness with author Paul Bogard. He's the he wrote The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. We still have some time to take a couple calls. If you have a great story about a dark, starry sky or just a question about artificial light pollution, you can call 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, one thing that came to mind last night, this was kind of funny because I try to sleep in total darkness, but when I get up at night, I'm clearly a grown woman, but I'm scared of the dark, so I always flip on the light. We have this kind of innate fear of dark, but it's kind of ironic that it's something that we're trying to preserve. And doing some good research, I read that you are actually afraid of the dark. How is it that someone who researches darkness, who often finds himself alone in a big forest or desert, is fearful of the dark?
Well, I try not to be alone too often. I think, you know, people always get a kick out of that, that I admit to being afraid of the dark. But, you know, I think a couple things. One is that I think a fear of the dark is just such a natural human reaction. It's a subject that people have written about and thought about for a long time, and I think it's completely okay and natural to be afraid of the dark. But what's happened for me is that I've grown to respect the dark so much, to understand how important it is for our mental and spiritual and physical health, for the health of the ecosystems that we rely on. For so many reasons, it's important that we, you know, I'm not saying don't be afraid of the dark, but I am saying recognize how important it is. And when you have the opportunity to get out and have experiences, these firsthand experiences with nighttime, with darkness, take advantage of those. Because as we've heard from some of the callers, you know, these wonderful night skies that you see, if you see the brilliant Milky Way one night, especially when you're young, you never forget it. It's just it's one of these amazing experiences that's part of being alive.
We have a caller who wants to share. Well, I'm not sure if they're still here, but we'll go to another caller, Judy. She's wants to share her starry sky experience. Judy in Columbus, thanks for calling the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I wanted to let you know, I guess it was 20 years ago, but we went out west and we were up about 10,000 feet, and we saw the most gorgeous in August, of course, those shooting stars.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you remember where out west you were?
In Colorado, near Mount Evans. Mm-hmm. And it's about 10,000 feet, and it was freezing, but it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I have seen that here in Columbus. I have gone out like at 2 a.m. and been able to see like tons and tons of shooting stars.
Mm-hmm.
Not as bright, but I've seen them.
Very good.
Yeah, and one more thing. In Athens, Ohio, if you go out farther than OU, you will be able to see the Milky Way. It's absolutely stunning.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Hopefully some of the callers are jotting that down.
Okay.
Thanks, Judy.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye. You know, after hearing this show, I can imagine some people are going to be doing what I did last night and thinking about their next big adventure, seeking out naturally dark skies. Where do we go? And, you know, to catch celestial greatness, if you will, where do we go? At what time of year do we need to go? Is there a better time of year?
Good questions. Yeah. You know, I think a couple things. One is simply to Google, you know, best star gazing spots, and there are a number of articles online that will show places both in the east and the west. There's another thing that folks can Google, which is called, just Google Dark Sky Finder, and there's a wonderful map that shows the entire U.S. and kind of the levels of darkness or levels of light in every place in the U.S. And I would just say that, you know, I just would really encourage people to do that, that this is really what my book is all about, is these experiences of being out in the night. So I'm, you know, whether it's I'm in a city like Paris or even Las Vegas at the beginning of the book, or down into some of these darker places like Death Valley, it's just really encouraging folks to get out and experience what nighttime really has to offer.
You know, a quick email from a listener, Paul, said that the darkest sky he ever saw was when he was in the Marines on a carrier sailing across the Atlantic in the 80s. The ship, he said, ran without any lights, and it made him understand why our ancestors were so in tune with the night sky. He could, you know, he says he wishes he could see that, what he calls, carpet of stars again.
That's a great image, and I've heard that many times from folks being out in the ocean, and folks in the military who've had that experience especially, and it just makes you envious. It makes you want to get on that carrier yourself and sail out into the ocean and just see this. But, you know, there is darkness closer to home, and again, I just want to encourage people to start seeing all the light that we live just kind of subsumed by all this light, and to realize that darkness is important wherever we live.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much, Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Hopefully this has been quite an informative hour for our listeners and an enjoyable one. We appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.